Hey friend, welcome back to the Semi-Seminary, and here we are another week, another installment of our Bible study series we're calling the Bible for Grown-Ups. This week, yes, and I'm going to say this reverently, finally, we have come to the end of our study of Job. It's not that I don't think that the book of Job isn't one of the most beautiful books in the Bible. I do. It's not that I don't think that Job doesn't have incredible theological insight. I do. It's just that there's so much more of the Bible that I want to talk about. So here we are. We're going to wrap up our study on Job as we go into this final chapter in which Job encounters God in a storm. I would like to go all the way back to the very, very beginning, because I'd like to just set the scene for where we are as we close the book by going back to the beginning, by recognizing that this book that we've been studying, the book of Job, the suffering involved is at the heart of all of our life story, of all humankind's story. Since all men and women in the earth, we all know the experience of suffering at one time or another, at least in our lifetime. This character of Job has universal appeal. His experience cuts right across centuries and centuries of time and hundreds of cultures. We all, as humans, feel an empathy and identification with this character, Job. And we also recall that the puzzle involved in Job is that this apparently righteous man, in fact, not apparently, is righteous, but apparently suffers for something that he's not done. Now, it's not as though Job has sinned. And we'll talk about this in the middle of the study, if you'd like to go back and check those out. This isn't that Job is someone who's never sinned. It's that we find that Job has actually met all of the requirements of law for atonement for the sins that he has committed. So on his balance sheet, for all of the sins that he should ask forgiveness, he's not only done that, he's asked forgiveness for sins he wasn't sure were committed, but he just wanted to make sure anyway. So it means that he's blameless, maybe not sinless, but blameless. And his righteousness shines through even as we go through the book. We find that he will be struck with physical ailments. He will be struck with the loss of family members, of fortune. But perhaps because of his righteousness, his greatest suffering is how all of these afflictions are compounded by a spiritual, a mental anguish. The perplexing question that many humans are asking in our world, maybe even you're asking yourself, why me? Why is it happening to me? What have I done to deserve this fate? What have I done to bring this upon myself? In the end, and we'll find tonight, we don't find concrete answers for those questions. But in true wisdom, by seeking a relationship by God, drawing into God, even in the midst of our suffering, we find an answer to a question that we didn't even know we should ask. What is the purpose of my suffering? Because now I recognize, now we'll find today, it's not that because we follow God, that suffering goes away. No. We're able to find peace in knowing that when we do encounter suffering, and we will, we can trust that there's a reason for it. I hope that you'll see that. And listen, I'll see you on the other side. So as we do come to the conclusion of this book of Job, it's interesting that just through this serendipitous timing, we're winding up the story of Job on Ash Wednesday, when one of the characteristics about this character in the story named Job is that he was a righteous man and had sought repentance by wearing sackcloth and covering himself in dust and ashes. The actual act of repentance that we will in some ways recreate tonight is something that we find in the story of Job. Now, as we've studied the life of Job, we saw in the three friends, the ones that originally had come to comfort Job, we saw that each one of them in their own way ruthlessly accused Job, and in turn, Job defended his integrity against their assumptions. We've read his mountaintop testimonies of faith in God, but we've also watched Job sink to the depths of confusion. As we read the accusations and the responses by Job, this dialogue throughout the story, we hear Job crying out to God, wanting to understand just what's going on. Because Job held the same belief as his three friends, that that good people are blessed and bad people suffer. But Job believed he had not done anything to cause his suffering. He had no idea. Remember, we've talked about this, I think, each week. Job had no idea of the spiritual dimensions of his test. Job doesn't understand what's happened between the accuser and God in heaven in the first two chapters of Job. We know that. We've read the story. Job doesn't know why. He had no idea to the spiritual dimensions of the testing he was under, and through all of it, God has remained silent. If you recall back in the ninth chapter, early on in Job's replies, that Job actually wanted to meet God in court so that he could prove his integrity. Instead, Job will end up, as we will discover tonight, meeting God in a storm. We can't dictate to God how God and when God may speak or not to us. Job's not going to get his questions answered also the way he thought he would. Instead, the Lord uses the textbook of creation to ask of Job over 70 questions that boil down to three big ones that we'll look at tonight. God taught Job what we can learn today. So let's look at the beginning of the Lord speaking, chapter 38. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I'll question you and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched out a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all of the angels shouted for joy, who shut up the sea behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, 'This far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves will halt.' Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown dawn its place that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and the upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the deep or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know this. What is the way to the abode of light, and where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You've lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm to water a land where no one lives, an inhabited desert to satisfy a desolate wasteland and to make it sprout with grass?
Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Can you loosen Orion's belt? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, "Here we are"? Who gives the ibis wisdom or gives the rooster understanding? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? God immediately lets Job know that the time had come to answer Job for ignorantly questioning God's wisdom. Then the Lord begins asking questions that let Job know how awesome God is and how small Job is. God's questions begin with the beginning, the creation of the universe. The origin of the universe is something that's captivated human minds forever. Yet the more we understand, it seems like, the less we truly know. And God is saying, Job, you didn't make the universe. I did. You can't answer my questions. Only I can. God's description about designing and creating the physical universe is beautiful poetry. Yet, God's statements that are scientific in nature are also remarkably accurate. So, when we read, "When the morning stars sang together," we now know that the stars do in fact sing, because stars emanate waves. Next, God questioned Job about the sea. God compared the creation to a building. Here he compared the sea's creation to childbirth. The oceans cover about 2/3 of the earth's surface, yet God, their creator, is the one that controls them. This is another example of God's greatness and Job's smallness. And then Job talks about the morning light. God talks about the morning light. Even with our scientific knowledge and advancements, it seems we still know fairly little about light and darkness. God's question about the sea reminds us today that we do understand that the sea has its own springs as well. God knows God's creation. Next, God asked Job about snow and hail and rain. And the word there, "keep up in a treasury" in 22, can also be translated as an arsenal. We see, in fact, God using these things, hail, for example, as a weapon in the Bible. And today, ecological science reminds us that all natural phenomena are interconnected and vital, but with the other questions, we'd be like Job, unable to give answer. God moved on then to the stars. The word bind in 38:31 is the Hebrew word for a cluster. When the Pleiades, when he mentions the Pleiades, Pleiades is a cluster of constellation made up of 7 stars that are visible to the human eye. They're bound together exactly the way that the Hebrew language puts it. But on the other hand, this is also kind of neat. Orion is made up of stars that seem to have no connection to each other. So in that instance, he says, "Loose the belt of Orion." How does the Bible know the difference, right? It's very interesting. God talking about creating the universe, including its stars. We pick up the end of 38 and the beginning of 39 here. 39, "Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions? When they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cries out to God and wander about for the lack of food? Do you know when the mountain's goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months until they bear? Do you know the time that they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labor pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who lets the wild donkey go free? Who unties its ropes? Jesus, God, now talking about who's in control of the universe. God's second question, who controls the universe, begins here with him talking about the animal kingdom. We know provides food for the animals, right? God does. God also oversees the various gestation periods among animals. As their creator, God's determined the cycle for each animal. No doubt Job was now overwhelmed by God's greatness, his vastness, and Job's smallness. God next questioned Job about the wild donkey and the wild ox, the mystery of their survival. God then reminds Job that he had no claim to amazing birds like the ostrich. Man does not create such an animal. God talked about the war horse, giving a realistic picture of the fearless war horse going into battle. And then later in 39, this was followed by the highlight of the hawk and the eagle who gave these birds their amazing abilities. Job knows he didn't, but God did. Chapter 40, the Lord said to Job, verse 2, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Then Job answered the Lord, I am unworthy. Job says, how can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once before, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. At this point, the Lord asked Job if he still wants to argue with him after all of this. And Job replies that he had already said far too much. Job 40 continues, then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? We'll come back to this. Verse 9. Do you have an arm like God's? Can your voice thunder like this? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at all who are proud and bring them low. Look at all who are proud and humble them. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself, God says, will admit to you that your own right hand can in fact save you. Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you, which feeds on grass like an ox. What strength it has in its loins, what power in the muscles of its belly. Its tail sways like a cedar, the sinews of its thighs are close knit, its bones are tubes of bronze, its limbs like rods of iron. It ranks first among the works of God, yet its maker can approach it with his sword. The hills bring it their produce, and all the wild animals play nearby. Under the lotus plant it lies, hidden among the reeds in the marsh. The lotus conceal it in their shadows. The poplars by the stream surround it. A raging river does not alarm it. It is secure, though the Jordan should surge against its mouth. Can anyone capture it by the eyes or trap it and pierce its nose? Can you pull in a leviathan with a fish hook or tie down its tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it keep begging you for mercy? Will it speak to you with gentle words? Will it make an agreement with you for you to take it as your slave for life? Can you make a pet of it like a bird? Put it on a leash for the young women in your house? Will traders barter for it? Will they divide it up amongst the merchants? Can you fill its hide with harpoons or its head with fishing spears? If you lay a hand on it, you will remember the struggle and you will never do it again. Any hope of subduing it is false. The mere sight of it is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse it. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. I will not fail to speak of Leviathan's limbs, its strength and its graceful form. Who can strip off its outer coat? Who can penetrate its double coat of armor? Who dares open the doors of its mouth, ringed about with fearsome teeth? Its back has rows of shields tightly sealed together. Each is so close to the next that no air can pass between. They're joined fast to one another. They cling together, and they cannot be parted. Its snorting throws out flashes of light. Its eyes are like the rays of dawn. Flames stream from its mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from its nostrils as from the boiling pot over burning reeds. Its breath sets coals ablaze and flames dart from its mouth. Strength resides in its neck. Dismay goes before it. The folds of its flesh tightly joined. They are firm and immovable. Its chest is hard as a rock, hard as a lower millstone. When it rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before its thrashing. The sword that reaches it has no effect, nor does the spear or dart or the javelin. Iron it treats like straw and bronze like rotted wood. Arrows do not make it flee. Slingshots are like chaff to it. A club to it seems but a piece of straw. It laughs the rattling of the lance. Its undersides are jagged pot shreds, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. It makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron, stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. It leaves a glistening wake behind it. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is its equal, a creature without fear. It looks down on all that are haughty. It is a king over all who are proud.
Hey, friend, if you've made it this far in the podcast, I was wondering if I could just take a second to ask a quick favor. However it is that you're listening to us, if you could subscribe to us, however that you're listening, if you could subscribe or follow to let yourself know whenever we have new episodes coming out. More importantly, if you could rate us, if you could provide us a review on however it is that you're listening, it really helps us out. It also gives us some feedback. Just to let us know you're out there listening, you appreciate what we're doing. It's very, very kind to have caught the feedback that we've received from people so far, and we would love to hear from you. So if you could rate the podcast, if you could review the podcast, please make sure to hit subscribe or follow. That way you'll catch all of the new content here. We certainly would appreciate all of it. Now back to our story tonight.
God asked Job if he could run the universe better than he can. Would Job discredit God's judgment? In maintaining his own innocence, Job had impugned God's justice. Many people talk about what they'll say in God's presence, but the truth, friend, is the closer that we actually get to our holy God, the smaller we become. God next told Job that if he's going to play God, remember he needed to dress the part. And he also needed to act the part. If you're going to be God, then pour out your wrath. Humble those that are proud before you. You remember him asking. Was Job capable of taking on God's role? And then God does the next, in the next part, does an amazing thing. He highlights two of his creations. The first was Behemoth, which is probably the hippopotamus. But many have also argued that it could be just some prehistoric type of dinosaur. And then the next one that he talked about for quite a while was the Leviathan that's generally thought of to be a crocodile. The crocodile is one of the most vicious of all creatures in the animal kingdom. And unlike an alligator, which won't attack unless it's provoked, a crocodile will actually pursue people. In God's questions, God demonstrates that these animals are beyond human control. And Job understood he had no way to fight creatures like this, yet he had been willing to have a fight with their creator. Through these questions about who created the universe, who controls the universe, who comprehends the universe, God taught Job and continues to teach us who really is control. Because we're far off We are far better off trusting this all-powerful and loving God rather than our own knowledge. So, let's pick up Job's reply in 42. Then Job replied to the Lord, "I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge?' Surely I spoke of things that I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, 'Listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me.' My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Epilogue, verse 7. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "I'm angry with you and your two friends because you've not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. So now take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourself. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You've not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. After Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord restored his fortunes and gave him twice as much as he had before. All of his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him before came and ate with him in his house. They comforted and consoled him over all the trouble that the Lord had brought on him. And each one gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former part. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jeremiah, the second Keziah, and the third Kiran Hapuch. Nowhere in all the land were they found women as beautiful as Job's daughters. And the father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation. And then Job died, an old man and full of years. These are words of submission in Job's reply, words of concession to an overwhelmingly powerful God. Among Job's words, these perhaps most affirm how God assessed Job's character all the way back in the beginning, that he was a righteous man, and God explained what made him righteous in God's eyes, right? All the way back in chapter 1, Job was a righteous man. Why? Because he feared the Lord. And this response of submission, this response of concession by Job truly shows that he has the capability of that knowledge we get through fear in the Lord. Any person, friends, who genuinely, truly, humbly submits to the Creator's majesty and power stands out in our universe as unique, because it is against all natural inclination. In our story, God has revealed himself to Job as the all-powerful creator of the universe, and Job submits to the omnipotent God. Job's words of submission employ the verb to know that is so prominent in God's speeches. Now, Job's knowledge is adequate. He doesn't possess a knowledge of the universe as such, but it's adequate because he can rely on and have faith in the knowledge that the Lord of the universe is there and can do all things. We started all the way back in the beginning asking, why me? Why does it seem like bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? And we just feel like sometimes it doesn't seem like it's fair from God. Why me? Almost everyone asks that question when some terrible suffering strikes in their life. An automobile accident, a diagnosis of cancer, long-term diseases like arthritis. Each one of these raise question in our lives, why does God allow pain? And over the centuries, suffering Christians have gained help and comfort from studying this book, the book of Job. Even though this book doesn't give them or us any compact theory as to why good people suffer. Thousands of years later, Job's questions have not gone away. People who suffer still find themselves borrowing Job's own words as they cry out against God, seemingly having a lack of concern. But the book of Job does something super, super important. It affirms that God is not only not deaf to our cries, but is still in charge of the world, no matter how things might look. God doesn't answer all of Job's questions, but his very appearance caused Job's doubts to melt away. Job learned that God cared about Job, and that God rules the world. And that should be enough. Earlier, Job had been convinced that God was angry with him and that he had become God's enemy. He'd cursed the day of his birth, if you recall, way back in the beginning because of the suffering that he was experiencing. He'd been angry at God's silence. He had demanded in a court of law, right, that his argument be heard. He had wanted to do what God had failed to do, provide him vindication. But after God finished speaking, Job acknowledges that he had been talking over his head, because Job acknowledges that he had been speaking of things he does not fully understand. Even though Job didn't receive a lesson on his suffering, it was sufficient of him to know that a reason exists. If he had an opportunity to do over again, Job probably would have just tried perhaps to trust God a little bit more and complain a whole lot less. Part of Job's problem, and our problem, had to do with what we don't and what Job didn't, in his case, know. After he encountered the sovereign God, Job regretted the presumptuous statements that he had made about God. He came to realize that God is sovereign over everything, including the moral order of the world, and that nothing can part him from divine permission. Perhaps the most comforting revelation of all for Job was that God was still his friend. Though he seemed silent or even absent, God was no mere spectator of Job's suffering, because God had been with Job through the entire experience. Any questions? Killer.
Isn't it true that there is some comfort just in knowing that there is a reason for whatever it is we're going through? Regardless of whether the reason might be something positive or it might be something we might perceive as negative or difficult, at least there's a reason that it doesn't feel just circumstantial to us, that we don't feel like that there's no reason, that we can't trust that in some way through the end of this storm we're stronger, we're better, we're more prosperous, we're happier, we have more peace. Not in knowing why me, why is this happening to me, but being able to trust in at least the fact, even if we can't fully perceive it, that at least there is a reason for it. God doesn't make suffering go away. God, though, provides us a reason for the suffering. And when we know that reason, when we can trust in that reason, at least it can give us some faith and some peace to persevere. And that's something. It doesn't take it away, but at least it gives us a reason to keep on fighting. Hey friend, I hope you've enjoyed this study on Job. Hope you come back next week here on the Semi-Seminarian. Until then, be blessed.